Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What role has U.S. policy played in the sectarian violence that's come roaring back to Iraq in recent months? And how did a military campaign expected to be over so quickly spiral into such a quagmire for the United States, its allies, and the people of Iraq? A new Frontline documentary called Losing Iraq airs tonight on PBS stations across the country, including KERA Channel 13 television in North Texas tonight at 9. Its producer Jim Gilmore is here to talk about the history of the war and how it relates to the depressing news breaking from Iraq in recent days as the branch of al-Qaeda known as ISIS gives Sunni extremists control over growing sections of the country. Jim, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate it.
The film opens with that famous video of the toppling of the statue of Saddam Hussein in Baghdad, which, like so many other things in a very complicated story, turns out to be a little more complex in reality than the triumphant U.S. response would have suggested.
Yeah, a lot more complicated, unfortunately. We went in very idealistic, very much with great hopes of creating a democracy, very much feeling that we could get out quickly, and ignoring warnings that once we went in, we owned the consequences of what would happen. And there were a lot of voices saying it is such a complicated neck of the woods. The fight between the Sunni and the Shia and the Kurds was something that was only contained by the strong-armed policies of Saddam Hussein. There were warnings, but we didn't listen to them, and the results is sort of what we see today.
How did it happen that so many U.S. experts failed to consider the possibility of an insurgency?
You know, we talked to a lot of people that were over there at that time, a lot of people that were in the military. I don't tell you the truth, I don't know, because there were warnings, there were very smart people that suggested the possibilities of it, but the mood of that time, and I guess we can all remember that to some extent, was there was a fear out there of what had happened in 9/11 and what could happen again. There was a belief in Washington by the neocons and such that this was a decision that had to be made. This is a direction we should have gone for many, many years. And I think naivete is unfortunately the reason for it.
So you mentioned the Sunnis and the Shia and the Kurds. Can you remind us of the population dynamic in Iraq and how sectarian tensions in particular have played out in terms of control of things like wealth and power?
Well, Saddam Hussein, of course, was head of the Ba'ath Party. The Ba'ath Party was Sunni. The minority party within Iraq, and the Shias once the Americans came in, the Shia were really put in a place of control. Though as the years went by, the United States understood that the only way this thing would hold together was if there was a partnership that was developed between the Kurds, the Sunnis, and the Shia. And for many years, I mean, really from the insurgency on, there was an understanding that this was something that would have to happen. Once we figured out that there was a possibility of an insurgency, once we started to figure out a little bit more about the divide, this unbelievable divide between the Sunni and the Shia, we started trying to make up for the mistakes that were made before. But what happened is, really, it is a history of mistake after mistake. There were good times, certainly during the period of the surge, 2007, 2008, really up to 2011 when we left. The problems were somewhat contained. We had found some answers. We had put into power politicians that we thought we could trust and we thought would be less sectarian than others, specifically Prime Minister Maliki. But we also understood that there were great dangers, and there were certainly warnings early on about Maliki and his sectarian nature in the end. But we didn't seem to have the cards in our hand to play the game that we really wanted to play, and we just kept on backing a losing hand in the end.
We will definitely get back to talking about Nouriel Maliki in a moment, but I do want to talk about L. Paul Bremer, who was tapped to take it on when the Bush administration decided relatively early to hand control over sort of operating this country in chaos to a civilian. Why did they choose this person with no practical experience previous to this in the Middle East?
Because Bremer was well respected. People in the vice president's office were friendly with him and thought he was the quote unquote the right kind of conservative that would be the right person to put into power. He's certainly a smart man, certainly very flamboyant in his way, and comes off well in the press. But he didn't really understand that neck of the woods. He went in very naive about what should happen. He really took over and did not listen to somewhat savvy advice of the folks that had already been there about some of the major decisions. And within a week of arriving, he put through the CPA rules number one and number two, which were de-bathification, pulling apart and dissolving the Iraqi military. And those two rulings themselves really led to the sectarian divide that would come about in 2006 when basically Iraq was in the midst of a civil war.
So suddenly you have tens of thousands of people tossed out of their jobs, even if they had had no direct role in abusive treatment.
Right, teachers and others that were members of the Ba'ath Party could no longer remain in their jobs, and we talked to people that were there that counseled Bremer at that point to explain to him that immediately you're going to have 30,000 to 50,000 Ba'athists out on the streets. You're going to have people that are going to turn against you at really the wrong time. And this is a very dangerous direction to go. Understanding the bigger story of Iraq and the Middle East, which is you have to bridge the divide. You have to, for any government to really work, you have to be able to have the Sunni and the Shia work together. But that was something that was just considered to be the consequences of a policy that we just had to go forward with, and it was a mistaken one.
Are there Sunni and Shia in Iraq that are not particularly sectarian or political? I mean, have these things been exacerbated by the violence of the last decade?
Yeah, I mean, the lesson of the surge. I mean, when Ryan Crocker came in as ambassador and General Petraeus, who was head of the American military, the coalition military, there was an understanding that this divide had to be fixed, and there was work to bring the Sunnis into the fight against the insurgents and against al-Qaeda and provide them a place at the table in the body politics. And they really, for those years, and that really did solve to a large extent, which, again, we have to remember that there were an awful lot of people that said the surge was going to be a disaster, that the Bush administration had lost this war, and that this was just a last gasp that would not work. But the reality was, because they were able to create the Awakening Councils, brought a lot of people on the payroll, basically, that had formerly been Sunni insurgents, that formerly had been shooting at American soldiers, because they were able to accomplish this, there really was, between the years of 2008 and 2011, when our military pulled out, And at a time of relative peace for at least what had been going on beforehand and certainly what's going on now.
Talk about the initial purpose for the Abu Ghraib prison complex and how it ultimately turned into like a de facto boot camp for terrorists. People who went in sort of neutral on this whole thing left really hating the United States.
Well, I mean, there was an attitude at one point when we tried to sort of deal with the insurgency, when we finally realized what was going on, where our military would go into small villages and just take people en masse and bring them and put them into prisons. And Abu Ghraib which is a very convenient location to Baghdad. It's out west of Baghdad, and it's actually an area that I only had one trip to Iraq, and we spent a couple of days and nights at Abu Ghraib. It was the place where a lot of them prisoners were brought, and we, in fact, came in the night we arrived, and there were a busload of these people from some raids that had been done being brought in and all sort of hands behind their back and taped and sitting being interrogated when we arrived. They were brought in there, and what happened is this became a training ground for people who had been moderates, who were very angry about the way they had been arrested, and many of them who were innocent, who were thrown into this Sunni cauldron of hatred towards the United States, and it really did become an area where Al Qaeda and the insurgents were able to find new recruits, and I think that haunted us for quite a while.
Before the surge, we had the light footprint strategy. Can you tell us what that was and how it ultimately empowered the insurgency?
Well, General Casey, who was in charge at that point, that was sort of the direction he was taking, along with Rumsfeld's belief. I mean, remember early on, Rumsfeld, along with a lot of the DOD at that point, their intention was to get in and get out as quickly as possible. They felt that this was that we'd hand off the government immediately to Iraqis, and again, optimistically feeling that we knew the right people to hand off to and get out. And then as things, we sort of got tied more and more in there because of the insurgency, and that just wasn't a possibility. But the light footprint that really didn't change until the surge began in 2007, the idea was that, you know, we were tired of losing people to the war. We felt that the insurgency couldn't be contained in other ways and that our troops would be used in a different way, and that meant that all the troops were held back in the main fortresses, the army camps that were placed all over Iraq, and they would only go out in force in their Humvees and go out to areas when they were doing raids or trying to deal with a situation. As someone calls it, was really war tourism more than anything else, and this was the belief that this is the way we would prevent further deaths and injuries to our soldiers, and that we would deal with the problems in a harder form, but without the chance of loss of life because our men and women were sort of out in the communities, which is really what. To fight an insurgency, you have to do, and really what, when General Petraeus came in, then happened.
Were we naive to think that the elections would sort of put Iraq on a straight path toward progress?
Yeah, I'm unfortunately, I think so, and we were naive in many ways, but this certainly was one. In 2006, our man was Maliki. I mean, we were responsible in a lot of ways for Maliki taking power, we always thought that we could control the politicians that we supported, and that elections, which were for people on the ground at the point that these elections were taking place, the early elections, they were very optimistic about it because they were real. They were the people of Iraq who were coming out in large numbers, and these were people that were threatened with death by the Al Qaeda and the insurgents if they would deal if they would actually take on democracy and vote. But there was optimism.
Let me jump in. We have to take a quick break. My guest is filmmaker Jim Gilmore. The Frontline documentary Losing Iraq airs tonight at 9 on KERA Channel 13 Television.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration opens August 5th. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with filmmaker Jim Gilmore. He produced the frontline documentary Losing Iraq, which airs tonight at 9 on KERA Channel 13 television and at PBS stations around the country. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. And Jim, before the break, you were talking about the fact that we have made the mistake multiple times in this country, but certainly with Prime Minister al-Maliki, of thinking that the leaders that we support in foreign countries will be fully controllable throughout time. Can you talk about the effect of the Sunni boycott on the perceived legitimacy of the elections that put al-Maliki in power?
Yeah, which was sort of where we were going before we left off. The reality is it seemed to us that the elections were successful. It seemed that the Iraqi people were willing to give up their lives, possibly, to vote. But the problem is what we ignored was that there was a boycott by the Sunni population. And what that led to was the Sunni population being cut out completely from the government. And that led to, it sort of fed on itself, and it led to more discontent and eventually gave more energy to the insurgency, which soon after, by 2006, was turning slowly into a civil war. So those elections, those early elections, which originally we saw as being very successful and that we spent a lot of energy and a lot of capital, a lot of lives of soldiers who were trying to quell the situation, for instance, in Fallujah before the elections. And in the end, they weren't the success we thought, again, because of this intransigent problem of always having to understand that you always had to be moderator between the Sunni and the Shia. And until we understood this lesson, we were failed to doom, to be doomed.
And I think this bears elaborating on this idea that what started out as an insurgency bloomed into a full-scale civil war. Can you sort of explain for people how those two things ultimately really were different in practice?
Well, it took because of this discontent. I mean, as you brought up early on, I mean, you can't forget that there were certainly moderates within both the Shia and the Sunni communities. They had been living together for generations and generations. There was lots of intermarriage and such. And so what happened is the war sort of brought out the greater evil in the humanity, basically, and it pulled apart sort of a very intricate web of the connections between the two groups. And decision by decision, from, as we were saying, de-bathification and the military and all, and ignoring the fact of the results of these elections and not picking the right people to back, all these things led slowly towards the insurgency taking on really a tenor of a civil war. It really did become a civil war more than anything else. And again, we were caught with our pants down. We were absolutely surprised that this would happen in 2006. And it was at a point when the Bush administration was really at a loss at sort of what to do, and it was the thing that really would trigger some radical decisions that in the end were much more successful than anyone ever thought were possible.
Okay, who was Nouri al-Maliki before he sort of stepped up to take control in Iraq?
Well, he was a politician. He had been fled Iraq under when it was in control of Saddam Hussein. He had spent some time in Iran. He had spent some time in other countries in the area. When he came back, he was involved with the de-bathification sort of part offices of the government. He was an advisor to some of the other leadership at that point. He was not that well known. But he was someone who the United States came across and saw as a possible somebody who was moderate, more moderate than others, had an ability to lead, was a strong individual, and the attention sort of focused on him. Rather surprisingly, actually, and it was our government that sort of decided to get behind him and to push him for the role of prime minister.
I had not heard the accounts of him basically relying on President Bush himself for, if not politics 101 advice, certainly for a lot of, I guess, basic advice about how to do this job.
There were... There were weekly teleconferences, or not every week, but many weeks in a row, there would be these teleconferences that the president would be involved in, and Nouri al-Maliki would also be involved in. And the Americans saw it as a way of helping him learn how to lead, to advise him, to go over every major decision that was being made. For a long period of time, there was a very close relationship between the president and Maliki. And Maliki really did feel totally connected to the administration and very, very much supported. And there was, of course, though there were worries, Stephen Hadley, who was the national security advisor to President Bush, spoke with us for the program, and he wrote an early memo saying that we have to be very careful here, Maliki is perhaps more partisan in a fashion that we don't understand, and yet the president believed that he saw in this man someone who would be willing to accept our advice, was moderate enough for the region, our government threw the full support behind him because of this.
Can you tell us about President Bush's final visit to Iraq as president?
Yeah, I mean, when he went over, I mean, those around him told us that, he felt, responsible for this war. He had felt responsible for the government that was in place, and he wanted to go over there one more time to say goodbye to Maliki, to see the troops, and to pay his respect to the troops, and wanted to see it for himself one more time before he left office. And there's this fateful press conference where a journalist threw two shoes at the president and barely missing him. And it was a real embarrassment to the president. It was certainly a show of disrespect. The journalist later said that he blamed the president for the hundreds of thousands of deaths of innocent Iraqis. But it was even more of an embarrassment for Maliki. Maliki, who had a very strong relationship with the president, who was embarrassed by a countryman of his to show such disrespect. And it was just, I guess, a sign in some ways of the fact that though things at that point were going much better than they had been going, that there were serious problems to deal with in the future. And I think it set a tone for that trip that was very unfortunate.
So less than a month after the shoe-throwing incident, Barack Obama is inaugurated as president. Here is a person who has campaigned on a promise to end the Iraq war, but was warned repeatedly not to set an arbitrary withdrawal deadline.
Yeah, I mean, he had gone over to Iraq in 2008, and he sat down with General Petraeus, and he, at that point, was warned by the general and also the ambassador, Ryan Crocker, that we had to be very careful. The reality was the United States government was hardwired into the political system, was hardwired into the military system, and we had to be very careful about how we disconnected, basically. Of course, what had happened was that the Bush administration had agreed that we were pulling out. There had been an agreement made in 2008, late 2008, after this sit down with the ambassador and the general, where we admitted that we were going to be pulling troops out by the end of 2011. And Obama sort of took this up as the direction that he was headed anyway. He wanted to get out of there a lot quicker than that. But this, in fact, was one way that the Bush administration made sure that we would stay until at least the end of 2011. And there was also a belief, and that by the Bush administration, and really the Obama administration when it first came in, that we would leave a residual force behind, a residual force of up to 25,000, maybe more, troops that would be there to train the Iraqis, would be there to be our eyes on the ground, would be there to sort of help us continue leverage and continue to be politically involved as well. And that fell apart, and that's also talked about in the film some. I mean, that's a sort of a fateful decision, is that when that negotiation fell apart, when there was a decision at the end that there would be no troops left behind, that everyone would pull out, that we were turning our backs to some extent on the situation in Iraq, both militarily and in the end what it turned out to be was politically as well. A relationship between President Obama and Maliki never really formed up anywhere near the relationship that Maliki had with Bush. And in the end, what happened was Maliki sort of decided at some point that he was going to be left and be on his own, and he sort of became much more partisan and started making decisions that in the end would cause a huge rift between the Sunni and the Shia populations.
So Maliki essentially felt like, okay, the Obama administration is not going to be paying as much attention to what takes place here. I'm going to consolidate my power. How did he go about trying to protect himself and to ensure that, say, Sunni commanders were replaced in the military with Shia commanders?
Yeah, I mean, he, what all the experts tell us is that he made some very strategic decisions, and including immediately after the American troops left in December of 2011, he went after some of people that he considered to be his enemies, including the vice president, who was a Sunni, and many others that soon after, where he deposed them. He sort of threatened to arrest them for certain crimes of treason and such. He went to the military and he took out some of the leadership and put in his own cohorts, to that people that he believed in that were faithful to him. Now, what had happened over the years, of course, when General Petraeus was there and Ambassador Crocker were there, is that they had carefully put into place people in leadership positions in the military who were trained by Americans and who were able to they believed, had taken over where the Americans left off. And what had happened when Maliki started making these changes is he put in place people that were just not up to the job. And that would haunt us later when, for instance, in Mosul, when ISIS came in, the leadership all left. I mean, there were 30,000 troops or so of the Iraqis that were there that certainly could stand up to the much fewer ISIS folk that came in. But the leadership all disappeared, and the reason for that is because the leadership was just not up to the job. So just one more problem, one more mistake that unfortunately we're involved in creating.
So why did the United States, when Maliki started behaving in these ways, why did we not object to a greater extent, or were we simply not in a position to say anything about it?
Well, I mean, early on, the decisions were made because they didn't see anybody else who could do the job that they felt they could control. Later on, we lost leverage. I mean, we no longer had 130,000 troops on the ground. We no longer had the numbers of State Department people that we had at one point. We no longer really had the control financially of the situation, because by the end, during the Obama administration, the amount of money that the Iraqis were then earning from their oil revenue allowed them to sort of have that ability to control their economy as well. So we lost the leverage. So it changed over time. It just started out because we knew no one else that we could depend upon, and in the end, it was because we had lost total leverage to control the situation on the ground, I think. But a very complicated situation, and, you know, there had been warnings all the way through. I mean, we talked to some of the people who had sent those warnings on to First President Bush and then to President Obama, that this was, you know, a huge problem, that the bottom line is if you could not deal with the issue of keeping that bridge very strong between the Sunni and the Shia communities, then everything would fall apart. And yet, we were just not up to the job. We were not able to achieve that.
There's an interesting moment in the film where we see tape of President Obama essentially declaring victory in Iraq, I guess on the grounds that we were out of there, good for us, regardless of the consequences there.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think the president always had from early days in his campaigning and such. I mean, he considered this the bad war, and that the good war was Afghanistan, and that's where we should be focusing on. But they were quite unawares of sort of what, you know, cutting all the connections that we did cut would actually accomplish. And in the end, you know, I think our worst nightmare has occurred because of it. And it also had to do with ignoring or not dealing forcefully enough with the situation in Syria, the ability of the Iranians to back the government in Syria was due to some extent because we had no forces in Iraq to prevent the overflights of material up to Syria, the Syrian government. It's you know, one problem after another, and it was due to a belief that we could disconnect from Iraq. We had been there for 10 years. You know, the American people were fed up with it. The Iraqi people were fed up with it. The ability, for instance, when we tried to set up a situation where we could leave some troops behind, fell apart because some say because Maliki refused to allow it, that there had been agreement with the Iranians that he, in the end, would prevent it from happening. And certainly there was a situation in the United States of sort of being very happy that it fell apart, because then we could pull out.
My guest is filmmaker Jim Gilmore. We're talking about the Frontline documentary Losing Iraq, which airs tonight at 9 on KERA Channel 13 Television. Join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration opens August 5th. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with filmmaker Jim Gilmore, who produced the Frontline documentary Losing Iraq, which airs tonight at 9 o'clock on KERA Channel 13 Television. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. All right, Jim, tell us a little bit about the formation of ISIS. It originated, I guess, with Sunni insurgents, tribe members who had lost patience with Maliki's abuses and then were sort of armed and encouraged by participation in the Syrian war?
Right. I mean, the border sort of didn't exist when between the two countries in a way, and insurgency moved back and forth. It grew during the Syrian revolts of a war that really has been going on up there, and it grew in strength, and it learned how to fight as a real military. The real strength, though, for the ability to come through and take over the north and the western areas of Iraq really occurred because of the many Sunni that had lost faith in the government. The Maliki's hard attempts to sort of get rid of Sunni leadership, to get rid of those in positions of power in the military, his ways of dealing with Sunni demonstrations in a very vicious fashion, It really his throwing off of the, many Sunnis off of the getting from their paychecks and in some of the situations that they were involved in. There was a loss in faith, a loss that a belief that there was a place at the table anymore for the Sunnis. And what happened there is the Awakening Councils and many other Sunnis that had worked closely with the American government during the surge and was supportive of the Iraqi government through those years had given up hope that Maliki could be dependent upon, and they backed ISIS when ISIS came down, or they just did not back the government in Baghdad. And what that allowed for was ISIS to come down very strong and very fast and take over major cities like Fallujah and Mosul because they were no longer standing with the Iraqi government. And that led to the problem in the area that they have now, and is what has also led to is a backlash of the Shia forces in the southern part of the country. And so therefore we are getting very close to a civil war again, as we had seen back in 2006.
Are Iraqi Shiites in full support of Nuri al-Maliki? Is he like their guy, or is he a guy who's on their side and therefore they back him?
Well, I mean, there's a divide. I mean, there's certainly some that are supporting him, but more and more it seems that people are pulling away from their support of him. Sistani is one of the folks, chief religious leader, who has made it clear that Maliki is probably seen his day and it's time for him to leave. There are many others that are showing discontent, but there are Maliki is a very stubborn individual, and he's learned how to use power. He's learned how to hold power, and one former person from the U.S. government told me, in a way you have to understand that, see it from Maliki's point of view, is in that world, when you give up power, it's not that you're only going to retire and go out on your yacht and have a nice life afterwards. There's a very good possibility that you'll end up in a prison or dead yourself. And so part of his reluctance to give up power is possibly also because he's safeguarding his future himself.
Yeah, initially he committed, I guess, to self-imposed term limits, and he has not held to those promises. Does he have enough influence, enough power to sort of remain, I don't know, if not president for life, sort of just remain indefinitely in office?
I don't, from what people have told me, it doesn't seem possible. I mean, I think even the Iranians are questioning their support. I think there's an understanding that things are falling apart very quickly, and as the civil war sort of grows, I mean, there's the news today is there more and more car bombs in Baghdad. ISIS is gaining in strength, and so it certainly doesn't look likely. It looks like there'll be a need for different leadership at some point. But the question is then: is it too late? I mean, even if you did get someone who was able to bridge the divide again and start to bring back some of the Sunni folks that were willing in the beginning to work with the government, is it possible to bring back the Kurds? The Kurds themselves are making it very clear at this point that this has been the last straw, and that they are going to go their own way. They want independence. So the question is, can you put all the pieces together again? Is Humpty Dumpty possible to be put back together again? And the longer this goes on, the less of a possibility that is.
So last month, President Obama announced that he was sending 300 U.S. military advisors back to Iraq. Who are they working for or with? Are they consulting with the Maliki government?
Yes, I mean they're working with the military. They're. But I think the bigger story here is what they are is their eyes on the ground for the American military and the White House to better understand what's been going on. Because the reality was is that we had no idea what was going on. The fact that we were surprised by ISIS, the fact that we were surprised by some of the moves that Maliki made, is unbelievable. And one of the reasons for that was because we had no one there. We had nobody there who really understood what was taking place. So I think it's, you know, it's a mixture. I mean, there's certainly in the Pentagon, there's certainly a belief that we can turn this around. There's certainly probably on the ground right now connections being made with some of the Awakening Councils and some of the people that we worked with very closely in 2007 and 2008. There's an attempt to sort of see what can be done. And there's, I think, a hope that ISIS is going to be so radical, and this is how they have been acting so far, that they are going to turn the majority Sunni population away from them again because of the radical moves that they are making and the freedoms that they're going to take away from the Sunni population. The Sunnis, in the end, are the ones that are going to suffer the most because ISIS is going to be in control of the areas that are majority Sunni.
It is pretty terrifying when you have a figure like Ryan Crocker saying, you know, the worst is yet to come. They are probably sitting on the ground now figuring out the next way to hit us, us meaning the United States.
Yeah, I mean, we end the film with Ambassador Crocker sort of saying that and saying that, you know, as much as we're sitting in Washington talking about what we can do about ISIS, they're sitting in Mosul trying to decide how they're going to hit us next. And it's been clear from their leadership that they intend to meet us back in Manhattan. So it's a very scary situation. There are very few answers at this point. It seems to be very very unclear about what our next moves are. I mean, I was reading the David Brooks this morning in the New York Times, and he has this article which is basically saying that some people in the think tanks in Washington are talking about the fact that we're really in the beginnings of a 30-year war in that region. And it's not only Iraq. It's what's going on with Israel and Hamas. It's what's going on in Syria. Madeleine Albright last Sunday just looked at the state of the world, and she said it's a mess. We have not seen a situation as bad as this in many and many of years. So I don't know what the answers are. And the scary thing is that all of the experts that we talked to in making this film is very few people had many answers that they were depending upon.
What makes ISIS so much more dangerous to foreign enemies, including the United States, than even an al-Qaeda?
Well, you know, as some have said, it's al-Qaeda 6.0. It's stronger, it's larger, it has more money. They are very well funded from the money they took out of banks in Mosul and other places. They have oil revenues on the black market because they now control areas, oil rich areas. They have volunteers from throughout the world that are streaming in to sort of help them in their wars. And these Europeans, Americans, they say dozens of Americans, hundreds of Europeans, have the ability to go back home afterwards and take the knowledge that they have learned at war in Iraq and Syria. So it's a daunting task. They have borders. They're a country. They have money. They have a military. They have a military that's quite good, and they have volunteers. And that's a situation that as I said before, back in 2001, 2003 was our greatest fear, and it's something that Bin Laden's hope that something like this could be created, and we now have it in Iraq and Syria.
I recognize that you have a situation where you're dealing with sort of moral outrage and you're dealing with religious fundamentalism. On the other hand, I wonder, you know, because there are so many economic problems in the region right now, could something like, you know, not that we're going to put ISIS back on the payroll, but is there something we could do that is outside of traditional military engagement or even intelligence engagement that might make a difference?
I hope so. I mean, I know from the people that we talk to that's indeed what they think is happening right now. I think they are going through their Rolodexes and trying to work with some of the people that they, both on the Sunni and the Shia side, to sort of try to reconfigure this world. I know there's a huge move to get Maliki out from many different directions. Certainly there's hope. And I think there's also a belief that you know, it's not too late to sort of stop the divide and stop a possible civil war from taking hold. So, I mean, certainly the people that we talked to had hope, but they also knew the possibility of it going in the opposite direction.
Can you talk a little bit about the process of reporting a story like this that has, you know, more than a decade of history involved, but is also, I would imagine, the script was changing and being adjusted up until very recently?
Well, yeah. In fact, we were still waiting to see, you know, is Maliki actually going to still be in power at the end and such. It's moving very quickly. At Frontline, we normally will have about 6 months to do a program. This film we did in 5 weeks because we knew it was an issue that we needed to deal with quickly. Our team had done about a half a dozen other films on Iraq over the past 10 years, and so some of the film comes from our archives. The earlier material comes from archives of things that we had already done. Because what we wanted to do was present the chronology of what has taken place and seen how American policies evolved over that period of time. But at the end, when you build a film chronologically, you're able to, if you need to make changes, you make changes to the very end of the film, and so it's possible to do. And so that's one of the tricks of the trades on how one can put a film like this together and still be able to change it at the last minute so that it's as up-to-date as possible.
It has to be fascinating, if also disheartening, to look at things that, if you were taking a clip that you used in a film 5 or 6 years ago, to recognize that we have very different perspective on some of these events now that time has passed and now that we can fully understand them.
Yeah, I mean, but it's also surprising when you look back at some of the people you talked to early on when we talked to people in 2001 or 2003, and you know, there were advisors, there were people in government that sort of understood what was going to happen and what was possible. It's the hard thing for any leader to know what to do, is to who to listen to and how to make decisions in these long lasting decisions. And once we went into Iraq in 2003, some people were saying that the end result would be exactly what has occurred, that eventually Iraq would break up into pieces, that you'd never be able to put the pieces back together. It's not an easy business, and it's one once you decide that you are going to be involved deeply in another country's affairs, such as we have done in Iraq, these are oftentimes the consequences, that it's much more complicated than one ever believes.
Jim Gilmore produced the Frontline documentary Losing Iraq, which airs tonight at 9 o'clock on KERA Channel 13 television and on PBS stations across the country. Jim, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you, Chris. It was my pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.